it's just ringing your machine.
Well, thank you very much, Todd, and thank you to John and Gunther for organising this nice meeting. This talk will be a little bit similar to talk I gave in the IPAM meeting in Lake Arrowhead. The advantage of that was it was exactly on time, which is pretty unusual for me. So, on the other hand, John gave a really good introduction to this topic, so maybe I can speed through a few parts. And if so, when I get to the end, we'll see how long. If I have a couple of minutes, I might take on one or two extra topics I've got lined up. Okay, so the theme of today is the optical, so-called optical tomography, and I'm going to carry on with that talk and talk mainly about the particular idea we have for applying this to brain imaging. And I want to say right away that it's a long history of people involved in this work, mathematicians, physicists, engineers, and clinicians. There's a partial list at the top of the principal protagonists who passed through UCL one time or another, some still there, and also had a good deal of collaborations with some groups around the world, some of whom are present. And of course, I've also had many really helpful discussions with many of the people here that have helped these ideas. So, roughly the format of the talk, some of the physical models I'll discuss again. As I mentioned, John has already done a good job on that. And then we're going to be principally concerned with the idea of solving an inverse problem, and therefore inherent in solving an inverse problem is the nature of the forward problem. Amy mentioned the importance of this. John has covered quite a deal about the inverse scattering approach, so I won't need to discuss that very much. Instead, I'll talk about the alternative idea of the optimization of a model fitting approach, and I'll show some results. And as I mentioned, if possible, I'll go to one or two extra sort of more novel ideas that we're working on. So this is the system that's been developed by the engineers in our group, principally led by Jeremy Hebden. Monster has an acronym which I can't quite remember, multi-channel optical near-infrared system time infrared, something like that. The key features are that it's the so-called time resolve system, so I think it even looks over, look, does some animation. Yeah, so the key idea is it's a so-called time-resolved system, so it has a pulse laser here which goes through a number of fibers into locations around the object we're interested in, and then we have detector fibers which are much bigger, which collect as much light as possible on within the location radius, and they go to this system here, which is a pretty complicated electronic system, but essentially what it is, it's a photon counting system. And it essentially constructs, here's a little cartoon of it, it constructs one by one, individual photon counting, the time of arrival, and builds up a histogram of the flight times of individual photons. And the thing is kind of adjusted, the overall limiting thing in these systems is how much light you can put into some of them without burning them. And for the kind of objects we're looking at, where we input the allowable limit of light, and we're looking at brain imaging of premature babies with a radius of something like maximum of 8 centimeters, then at the maximally attenuated position, sort of opposite the source where the light has gone through the maximum number of paths, we're collecting photons at approximately 1 photon per input burst. And it takes, we want to accumulate a histogram of about 100,000 photons to have an acceptable noise level. And the repetition rate is at 10 megahertz, so it takes about 10 seconds to accumulate that number of photons at each detector. because all the detectors operate in parallel, the ones near to the source get an incredible number of photons. In fact, we have to throw away photons using a variable attenuator. But the limiting factor is how soon we can collect sufficient statistics at the most distant detector. So it's not extremely fast, and that all goes for one source, and then the source is switched. So the time it takes order a minute or two to acquire the data, which is a bit slow. And the other feature about this, as has been mentioned, particularly by Amir, is the multispectral aspects are rather important. This is one of the selling points of optical imaging, is that you have the spectroscopic part to it. So in the current system, we only have two wavelengths of light, 780, which is a bit more blue, and 815, which is a bit more red. And this allows us, with these two wavelengths, to essentially get two images, and then you can do a tiny amount of correlation of that to the oxygen saturation in the blood and the oxygen volume in the blood, as John also mentioned. So the you can tell I didn't produce this picture, it wouldn't be possible, but this little thing produces that red and blue light, or going from one of these to the next, and builds up. Simultaneously, the thing is organized so that you can accumulate, so the light flashes go alternating, and this accumulation goes essentially switched, so that these are built up in parallel. Okay, well, I won't dwell too much on that, and that's just a picture to show it's not joking, it really exists. There's a laser source here in one cabinet. The whole thing is actually movable. So here it is sitting in a neonatal unit of the hospital. That's a baby there being scanned. Okay, so when you consider light propagation, there's quite a large number of physical... is this a laser point? Oh, okay. Actually, I quite like that one. Let's go to the... There's quite a lot of physical models that one might consider. I mean, in the most rigorous model, you would have to consider Maxwell's equation, because light is, of course, electromagnetic radiation. But it's not really conceivable to solve Maxwell's equations at this kind of wavelength and this length scale. So various other approximations are made. The principal one that's used is Boltzmann equation, which is an energy balance equation. Boltzmann equation itself comes in various varieties. We're mainly concerned with this, what we call a single speed Boltzmann equation, but there are so-called multigroup Boltzmann equation, which considers radiation at multiple energy bands. This is used a lot in the neutron physics community. And there has lately become some interest in variable speed Boltzmann. In fact, we heard a talk yesterday afternoon from Steve, which is considering a continuously variable speed. And, well, the Boltzmann equation still is a little too complex to work with for reasonable reconstruction time. So there are some other things that are being considered. Arnold Kim will be talking this afternoon, I think, about some other possibilities, one of which is Fokker-Planck equation in the very small scattering regime. But the principal one we go through is this so-called PN expansion. It means that one takes the directional information of the Boltzmann, of the propagation of photons, expands the direction on the sphere in spherical harmonics, and if you truncate this to a small number of spherical harmonics, you get the so-called coupled PN equations, and if you go all the way, throw away everything except the first one, you get the P1 equation, and then with a couple more questionable assumptions, you arrive at this diffusion equation, or slightly better, something called telegrapher equation. If you do that procedure with a variable speed, you get a kind of advection diffusion equation. So after these rather interesting questions about the correct model, we take just about the simplest possible one for now, called the diffusion equation. That's the transport equation. As I said, it's a balance equation. I think we've seen it once or twice this week. The essential components are the propagation. So if one had, as John mentioned, if you had no absorption scattering the medium, essentially a transparent medium, this transport term would just be solved to produce straight line propagation, and then your problem would reduce to a radon transform inversion. Photons are thrown away by absorption or scattering, but they're also added to the direction in which you're propagating by scattering from another direction with this probability F S hat S prime. And what one does in the the basic variable I is a five-dimensional variable, it's a function of five variables, three in space and two in direction, over time. And in the idea in the diffusion equations, we just ignore the direction of the propagation of the photons. We just look at the photon density. And then we arrive at this equation, which John also showed. And John mentioned that you can assume scattering constant, in which case this just comes outside here. We have d times Laplacian. But in a slightly more general version, we consider this as a spatial variable. And we take the divergence of the diffusion of this essentially this current d gradient phi. The absorption is the same as it was before, but this d term, which I haven't written up here, is related by taking the moments of the scattering phase function and producing the so-called diffusion coefficient. And of course there are many debates about the validity of this equation, but when all is said and done in the type of large scale problem that we're considering, because of the large number of scattering, we do have essentially a random walk process, and essentially a Gaussian random walk process that's reasonably well approximated in this fashion. All of this does break down under certain conditions, breaks down notably when the scattering is very small, and that can be a problem. If I get to it, we'll discuss that. And then through this procedure, we get this so-called Robin boundary condition, which relates the Dirichlet and Neumann data on the boundary, and the measurement is assumed to be the Neumann data. Just in case you are bothered about it, which you should be, why do we think it's reasonable to go with diffusion? Well, it's possible to solve Boltzmann equation using certain methods. There's a variety of methods. Here's an example. In the kind of regime we're talking about, with distances of something like 6 centimeters in the type of scattering parameters that John was mentioning, if you look at a point light source, you look at the decay in the photon intensity. When you solve with the transport equation, we get this, let's make sure I have it right, the blue line. So you get this sort of cusp and a decay here. And these lines are at cross-sections of certain distances from a source. We have a source here, and I'm looking at various lines, various distances away. And you can see that, I mean, most of the information, the blue line and the red line, are almost coinciding except for right near the source. And this is actually showing, if you take the, as I mentioned, the principle in the PN equations is to take the directional distribution on the sphere into a spherical harmonic basis. And if one does that and you look at the coefficients of the spherical harmonic basis, we see that this is the constant term, this is the first term, which is essentially a cosine, and the blue a sine, and then the next ones producing the coefficients of the higher order harmonics are falling away very fast. This is taken at a point somewhere along this line at some distance, 25 millimeters away. Of course, this all changes the nearer you are to the source and so on, and this is a long debate which is very interesting, but we don't really have time for it right now. And as John mentioned, one has the choice of inputting a pulse, looking at the distribution of paths, which equates under a time resolved system to times of arrival, or a time harmonic system which takes a AC modulation on the DC amplitude and looks for the change in the AC amplitude and also the phase shift. Now, There are two things. One is the way you measure the data, and the one way is the way you analyze the data. We measure in this system, but it's much more convenient for the purpose of exposition to discuss the analysis in terms of the frequency domain system, which we, of course, from in regard to the analysis we just obtained from Fourier transform of this histogram. So I'll be mainly discussing a frequency domain analysis. This is again another justification about the diffusion approximation. This shows some of the measured histograms. So these circles are the output of the system. They correspond to different distances from the source, and they've been normalized to have the same peak amplitude, because if I didn't do that, the ones close to the source would be significantly off scale. Or, of course, I could use a logarithmic scale, but then you would see a lot of noise in the tail. And what the point of this picture is to show the dashed line, which is the diffusion equation model for this particular case, fitting the data, you know, extremely well within the limits of the statistical variation in the noise. And in particular, one can have a lot of discussion, which is quite interesting, about what happens right around here, which is what John referred to as ballistic photons. And one can certainly show that the parabolic nature of the diffusion equation would give rise to something counterintuitive, because the solution to a parabolic equation has an instantaneous amplitude, arbitrary distance from the source, which is, of course, counter to relativity as well as everything else. It isn't commensurate with the propagation of light as we know it. And so if one takes better approximation, one finds that there is actually a step here. There's a dead time before which one get no photons. The first arriving photon is the this is nanoseconds. So this is 8 picosecond. This is picoseconds. 8 10 to the minus 9 seconds. Okay. Let's move on slowly. And another interesting question one can ask is regard to the information content. There are various ways that one might try to describe the information content, but here's one idea. Supposing I take a time-resolved histogram here. If I Fourier transform it, I find that the amplitude decreases with the with modulation frequency, as one might expect. This is something like the skin effect. The higher frequency waves are damped more extensively. And the phase increases with modulation frequency, as you might imagine. But the solid line here shows the gradient of the phase with respect to frequency at zero, which is equated to the mean time of flight, the mean arrival time. So if one takes the moments of this histogram, the vertical line here shows the mean, and this mean times frequency is this solid line, and we see that the deviation in the phase from the mean time is not very extreme. And if you look at the scale of this, this is 0.04 terahertz. That's 4 gigahertz. That's rather a high frequency for electronics to measure. In fact, most systems can't operate above around about 1 gigahertz. And at this regime, the divergence of the phase from the mean arrival time is rather minor. Also shown here is the variance. So one possibility is to describe this histogram in terms of the mean and variance and higher order moments. And one always finds this histogram is rather simple. It doesn't have a high frequency structure to it. It doesn't look like the solution to a hyperbolic propagation. It doesn't, for example, look like the kind of signal you get from an ultrasound system from a burst, as Sarah was talking yesterday, from a burst of sound. If you look at the frequency spectrum of this, you see high frequencies well propagated. This doesn't occur in our case. So the information content can perhaps be summarized reasonably well in terms of a few moments of this histogram. Another aspect of this, if we add some Poisson noise to the acquired data, rather like to simulate what I showed in the previous slide, and then look at the correlation and the amplitude over frequency, one sees again that the correlation is rather high. Of course, I should have rescaled this to 1, but never mind. The correlation between the measured amplitudes at the frequencies is very strong, again up to several gigahertz, which it may be impractical to measure. In other words, you could consider mesh sampling the Fourier transform at multiple frequencies below 1 gigahertz, but the data would be correlated and you wouldn't be adding much information. So these are roundabout ways to justify a simplification we're going to make, which is rather than deal with the arrival time of the photons as the data, we're going to deal with a transformation of the arrival time of the photons. And the two...
Yes. I don't understand the last...
This.
What is this curve?
This is the correlation coefficient.
Correlation?
Between the frequency, the DC frequency, the zero modulation frequency, the amplitude of the signal at the DC frequency and at higher modulation frequencies. So we simply add statistics.
It is not the correlation of the amplitude function which is here.
No, it's not the correlation of this itself. It's the correlation. What I've done is add statistical noise to this, take the Fourier transform, and build the correlation between the DC frequency and the modulation frequency.
But this is an experimental curve.
This is just a model curve. And via the moments, we can, in fact, reconstruct to some extent this time curve via the moments. And what's shown here, the blue crosses show, this is again a numerical simulation of different distributions, histograms of photon time of arrival, calculated using a finite differencing step, so sampled at quite a fine discretization in time, I think around about 25 picoseconds, whereas the green curve is an analytic curve reconstructed from the zero first and second order moments, so it captures this information rather well. Okay, let me move on a second. So let's now discuss things a little bit in terms of the frequency domain. Again, I think something similar to David Isaacson showing yesterday, if you consider the source radiation, so the incoming radiation, let's carry on. The incoming radiation, we call eta, is distributed on the boundary of the domain. We use m as a vector on the boundary of the domain, t in time. If we make this time harmonic, then we'll assume that the internal photon density is also time harmonic, and we obtain this frequency domain, PDE, just the Fourier transform of the parabolic equation had before. And the principal thing to note is that we can regard this as a complex valued attenuation coefficient, but the modulation frequency is known. And these, we already mentioned these Robin boundary conditions. So one can think of the analog to the Dirichlet, or I guess it was the Neumann de Dirichlet map that David Isaacson mentioned. Since we're measuring Neumann data, and since the boundary condition regarding the incoming distribution obeys a Robin condition, we'll call it the Robin to Neumann map. So this is for the elliptic equation, and this would be analogous, as we heard in a talk, those of you who were there, from Steve yesterday, to what's called the albedo operator. If we were considering the radiative transport equation as it's in its raw form, then this function eta would be a function not just of position on the boundary, but also of incoming direction, and the measurement data would be not just position on the boundary, but also outgoing direction. Now, by going through the diffusion approximation, we've relegated the incoming radiation to the averaged, the direction averaged incoming radiation. So it's just a function of position on the boundary. And similarly, the measurement is taken irrespective of the direction. So it's just direction averaged to a function on the boundary. So this is a linear operator. And so the question, as this was mentioned in David Isaacson's talk and in Steve's talk, is if we have knowledge of this operator, can we reconstruct absorption and diffusion coefficients in sign? So if we consider this now, the mapping from the absorption diffusion coefficients into the data, this is a nonlinear mapping. So one that you must bear in mind, you must keep thinking about how things might or might not change if we use transport. This is probably one of the most interesting questions. And we're going to consider that we have multiple incoming radiation distributions. Ideally, we would have complete incoming distributions and measure the complete data on the output. And then, according to the uniqueness theorems of Sylvester and Norman, if we measured this at two modulation frequencies, we would have a unique distribution of parameters that could be recovered. But of course, in practice, we're going to be limited to a finite number. So we want to consider a projection of a finite number of incoming distributions and see whether we can reconstruct some approximation to a unique solution. And so the full, another way to think of it is a nonlinear mapping of a function of four variables, the functions mu, a, and d in the interior, and the positions m and p, which are the locations of sources and detectors on the boundary. And as John mentioned, this is data y in the three-dimensional case is a function of four dimensions, two characterizing the source and two characterizing the detector. And then we want to make use of Green's function as a convenient notation to use. So the Green's function that solves the, we'll differentiate between the Green's function that solves the homogeneous boundary condition problem with an interior source. So we have a delta function interior to the domain with a zero incoming distribution, we call this G omega. Whereas we can also consider the case where we have a zero interior source and just a delta distribution on the boundary, we call this G del omega. And then a Green's operator will simply be the integral operator with the Green's function as its kernel. Measurement operator will just be the boundary derivative. And so we'll use this notation G of B to be the boundary derivative of a Green's function. So one of the ways, one of the basic tools is linearization. Again, I think I can go through this a little bit quickly because of John's talk. In the linearization around some reference state with some known distribution mu a d0, we perturb this with a change alpha beta in absorption and diffusion coefficient. Then we'll say that the source is unchanged, so that the perturbed potential satisfies the same right-hand side and the same boundary condition. And through some very well-known procedures, we can derive, as John mentioned, the Lippmann-Schwinger operator. He showed it with this term, and as he mentioned it, let's just include it here. We have this other term with the diffusion part of the perturbation, which is the product of the scalar product of the gradients of the fields. So this is one important feature, that we have these two parameters that we need to think about in the general case. There's another generalization again, which would be variable refractive index, and I think this is an untouched problem in many ways. I won't have time to discuss that. And of course, again, John mentioned one can formally expand the Lippmann-Schwinger in the Neumann series, and these individual terms correspond to the propagation from source to detector, the propagation with interacting at one site, absorption or detector at two sites, and so on. And if we truncate it, then we have the so-called Born approximation. And what the only difference from the Lippmann-Schwinger is that now this is the initial state, the field arising from the unperturbed or from the reference state, as opposed to in the Lippmann-Schwinger, it's the unknown field which you're trying to find on the right-hand side, which is why Lippmann-Schwinger can't be solved directly. So this is an integral operator, K acting on these terms alpha beta, which is the linearization. So if we solve this, we invert this linear inverse operator, we have a solution to the linearized imagery construction problem. Now, again, I've mentioned this briefly, and John touched on it. Let's just see what happens. The Born approximation in the simplified form doesn't really work very well, and there are various ways you might wonder why it didn't work. You might think it's because of the nonlinearity, and that's also true. From a formal point of view, that's probably the reason, but from a practical point of view, one of the reasons that it doesn't work is because if you're looking at the amplitude of received radiation, it varies with a very extreme dynamic range over the whole measurement surface. And the reason for that is because of the extreme attenuation of radiation. And again, John mentioned what is much more convenient is to take the logarithm of the received amplitude. So if you want to plot the logarithm of the amplitude over the distributed over the surface, you have a function which is much smaller dynamic range, obviously. But the implication for this in terms of the inverse problem, again being perhaps a little bit unrigorous, one can simply think of it as a functional transformation and apply a chain rule. This is how I like to think of what's known more correctly perhaps as the so-called write-up approximation. If we consider the logarithm of the change in the field, then we can expand it in terms of the Born series in a fashion like this. And the idea in the write-off is that rather than saying that the field phi is the Green's function plus an additional term, it's a product of the original field and the exponent of this series here, which is a more complicated series than the Born series. But if one looks at this term, this GVG over G, this is the same kernel that John mentioned as a renormalization of the Born approximation. Okay. So yeah, that's just formally saying from in the linearized system, we take the original operator K and we rescale it by the unperturbed or the measured field, and we obtain the linearization of the logarithm of the data. Looking again at the moments, if we now consider this logarithm of the data over frequency and expand it in a Taylor series, we obtain as the first term the logarithm of the DC amplitude, then I modulation frequency times the mean time, negative frequency squared times the variance of the time. And the contention is that if one is only concerned with frequencies up to, say, 1 gigahertz, as I mentioned, is a practical limit to the most measurement devices, then this series can be truncated either at the second or maybe even only at the first to give a reasonable approximation to what is going on with the complete data. In other words, I don't believe that there's a great deal of extra value in considering higher order amount of data. And because if you consider the full time data or equivalent, its Fourier transform, we have an extra dimension in the data which makes the complexity of the algorithm that much harder. So we're reducing this in this first stage by this procedure of taking the logarithm, either expanding in moments, which is what we do in practice, but for the purpose of this talk, we're just going to sample this at one relatively low modulation frequency and assume that this is valid and that even the second term is not going to be as significant. And here's an illustration of some justification for this. So let's look at, here's a simulated example in 2D. We have a circular domain. We have a number of inclusions in absorption and diffusion coefficient here. They're not all the same. Now, supposing that we cancel out all these blobs, we just look at this background, we create the field of the background, then we add all these blobs, create the field again, we look at the difference between them. It's complex, so we look at the real and imaginary parts of the difference of the internal fields. Now, this is not what we actually measure, because we can't measure inside. But if you look at, we're going to put a source at various locations around, and we just look at the difference in the real and imaginary parts, you see that they're very much concentrated around the boundary. If, on the other hand, we take the logarithm of the initial field, the logarithm of the perturbed field, take the difference in the real part of this, then this, of course, is the amplitude of the ratio of the perturbed to initial field, and now you see much more significant behavior. We see that just looking at the fields, we can see this structure kind of becoming apparent. This is the amplitude and this is the phase. So you can see that a large variation in this field corresponding to these. You can almost convince yourself that you can actually see, for example, this object here. Well, I've been looking at this a long time, so I can convince myself. Maybe you need a bit more time. But you can see this character turning up there quite nicely. So this would be beautiful if we could measure inside. Of course, we would have a wonderful system, but we can't do that. So this is just an illustration. So how long have I got now?
10 minutes.
Okay, so I'll just move on a little bit. So so this is just some formalism. We're going to regard the measurement. So we've described the system in terms of Green's functions for describing the propagating field. Now, the measurement has to be taken with a finite aperture detector, so we can regard the measurement as an inner product on the boundary of some function W, which represents the averaging of the detector with the propagation kernel here. This is the linearized problem and this boundary derivative. And by using the properties of the adjoint, we can therefore say that this is also equivalent to an inner product in the interior between the adjoint K star of this linearized kernel with the perturbation alpha beta. And then again, similar to David Isaacson mentioned, so I freely admit I've borrowed many ideas from EIT when we're developing this. So we need to develop the solution in a basis. And David mentioned on Tuesday that there's quite a lot of significance attached to the form of the basis. So we recently settled on using a smooth basis, usually a cubic spline basis or the so-called blob bases, which in inherently introduce regularization. In fact, basically the same idea to the approximate inverse or the mollifier idea that we heard about as well yesterday, developed by Alfred Lewis in Saarbrücken. So if one applies all these things, we have a discrete incoming field, we have a discrete aperture, we have a discrete base, then we arrive at a fully discrete system. And the matrix elements of the, so then our matrices K, absorption matrix, diffusion matrix, the measurement is a change in the data between some reference state and some measured state, and the unknown is just a linear arrangement of the coefficients of the basis for the absorption and the diffusion images, and the matrix coefficients are just given formally in terms of this kind of integrals over once over the domain and twice over the boundary domain. Okay, and let me briefly, I think this community knows very well about adjoint methods. The physical idea of the adjoint method summarized here: a forward propagating Green's function from a point r prime onto a measurement site m is the same as a slight rearrangement of a complex conjugate of an adjoint Green's function propagating from the measurement to the boundary point. And this has a physical meaning. The physical meaning has been known in the transport literature. In fact, this is nearly a quote from the book of Case and Zweifel. It says physically that the measured flux at a position m due to an isotropic source r is equal to the complex conjugate of the photon density r due to that's what we call a Neumann source at the boundary m. And if one looks just at rows of these kernels, we consider a single source and a single measurement, we'll get so-called sensitivity functions. I think I'll skip this a little bit. These functions are the ones that John was showing these so-called bananas, which in the radon case would be straight lines, in our case are concentrated near the source and detector. But let me skip this thing a little bit. So let's talk about nonlinear reconstruction. So the nonlinear reconstruction just builds really on this linearized idea, because now we're going to say that the forward mapping, which we had as a continuous function over spaces, functional of the functions mu a and d, by discretizing it, we obtain a a so-called least squares data functional, which is the discrepancy between the measured data and this discretized version of the full forward mapping. And as is usual, we augment this with this penalty term, J. This is well known from Bayesian theory to be equivalent to adding the so-called Bayesian prior. So the exponential, negative exponential of the penalty term is just the Bayesian prior, and this term here is assuming the Gaussian statistics. Is the distribution of the so-called likelihood, the distribution of the errors, assuming a Gaussian model, which could be changed, but I don't have time to talk about. And then optimization theory kicks in, and we simply apply any number of well-known minimization techniques. Again, I won't talk too much about this. There'll be a talk this afternoon by my collaborator Martin Schweiger, who gives some details of a rather efficient way to solve this optimization, a so-called approximate Newton method. But the basic idea is that we have a term here which is an adjoint operator acting on the discrepancy of the data. So this is like a backpropagation term. And then this funny thing here, which an optimization is called a Hessian, is simply an operator which takes the backpropagated image and in a sense filters it to give a better approximation. So I'm a little bit behind. I thought I was going to be ahead, but I'm behind, so I won't talk too much about it. And here's a sort of a picture of it. This example, we have a source, different numbers of sources on the boundary. We have a direct field. Again, of course, we don't measure the inside, but we're visualizing inside. This is the real and imaginary parts. Then we take the discrepancy of the data with this model field. And if we look at this in with source and detector, we get something like what you would have as a sinogram in CT. The diagonal has been cut because this represents where the source and the detector are at the same point. And this is something that causes us plenty of trouble, both instrumentally and from the point of view of the approximation breaking down. So we cut this piece out along the diagonal. But you see, this is just the data. You can see the real and imaginary part of the logarithm. So this is amplitude and phase. This is the adjoint field being backpropagated. And if you look at it, you see that there is some variability. There's some structure building up, which is just the back projection of the data. But it's hard to discern what it exactly is. If we take the product of the forward and adjoint field, we get the contribution for the absorption term. If we take the scalar product of the gradients of those fields, we get the contribution to the diffusion term. And what's being shown here is just the summing up, and it's negative, it's inverted, to give the approximation to the image. This is simply the back projection equivalent being assembled from each source into, of course, this is not being done in real time computationally, although actually in 2D the computation is easily as fast as this, but in 3D not so fast. And this is accumulated gradient here. And so the does this animate, or is that the next one? Okay. The iteration of that shows you the convergence to the image. And what's here? This is the this is the update. When you've achieved convergence, the update goes to zero. That's one test for how you've achieved convergence. So as we iterate through, this thing becomes decreased in amplitude. And this thing really just looks like a deep blurring process. Okay, and that's... I'm going to leave this because Martin Schweiger is going to give you more details about this. That was all in 2D. This is a 3D case showing a kind of... meant to be something like a optical tomography version of the Shep-Logan phantom. And these are slices, so this animation is showing successive slices moving up through here. This is the actual image, and this is the reconstruction image. Why is this blurred? Because it's been projected into the cubic spline basis. So this would be the ideal that we could receive with the cubic spline basis. The real thing, of course, has sharp boundaries, but because we have an ill-posed problem, the high frequencies are not going to be reconstructible anyway, so we just leave them out. So some results now. First of all, this is a phantom, so this is showing all this collection of fibers. These big fibers are go to the detector. These little fibers can't be seen here. This is a plastic doll's head So I just took a doll from a toy shop, made a mold of it and filled it up, hollowed it out, filled it up with resin. So this is like a glue, like an epoxy resin that you put it in, you put some hardener in, it sets. If you don't put the hardener in, it doesn't set. It's liquid and you can put things in and out. This shows, this is a digitized version of all that. That's actually obtained by putting the whole thing into a CT scan and using volume rendering. We use finite elements for everything, for the calculation of the field. So this shows the finite element mesh. These are the locations of the sources and detectors. And that shows some results. Absorption image, there were a number of different cases concerned. One had an absorber and a scatterer. So this is the absorption image, this is the scatter image. See a negative scatter, positive absorber. And lastly, some clinical results. This was our first clinical test. This was an infant with a left ventricular hemorrhage. This is the ultrasound image here with the left ventricular hemorrhage here. This is the full setup of sources and detectors in all its glory, and this is the absorption reconstruction. And if one is feeling in a good day, one says that the absorption is stronger on the left here than the right because the left ventricular hemorrhage is on the left. And concluding, more recent experiment was done looking at activation. So in a intensive care unit, one can do a moderate amount of functional investigation by changing the ratio of the gases that are breathed by the infant. If you can slightly increase the oxygen or the CO2 that's in the inspire, that's a legitimate thing to do, according to our pediatricians. It's sort of a minor amount, so it's quite safe. And this is the whole thing. So the whole thing is working in conjunction with all the other instrumentation in a neonatal unit. Some details. So this is 7 minutes per iteration. It's not so fast, but it's not so terrible either. And what was done here was increased in CO2 and increased in oxygen. Let's look at the results. Firstly, if you start with one measurement, do all these things and return, you should get something, you should get more or less the same image as before. This is what we get for the baseline. And the CO2 increases, the oxygen, the absorption generally increases throughout the brain, and this is shown here. Whereas the oxygen only increasing, it will increase the amount of hemoglobin that's in its oxidized form here. But if you increase, if you look at the other wavelength, so there's the two wavelengths, the main difference to spot is that now we have a decrease in absorption. This is commensurate with the spectroscopic information. So the fact that the CO2 increase is giving increase in both directions means that the blood volume is increased. The fact that here one is increased, one is decreased, means that there's an exchange of the absorption and so exchange between oxygenated and deoxygenated. So I'll skip the last part, which is about breast imaging, comes to the conclusions. Discussed optical tomography based on diffusion equation. I've talked, one of the main themes I've tried to emphasizes the limited information content in the frequency or time domain, so that one should exploit that, reduce the amount of data, make more efficient algorithms. Looked at the absorption of recovery, absorption, and scattering images, and an iterative approach. So, thank you.
We can at least a couple questions.
How many optodes did you have?
There are 32 in the system. They're not all active at the same time because there's just a physical limit to how many you can put on the head. So I think there's actually like 27 that are being used in that particular experiment.
How many degrees of freedom were you reconstructing?
The basis we used, I think it may have been, I'm not sure whether, actually no, it wasn't there. We used something like where's Martin? Like 16, 16, 16, that's a typical thing.
Yeah, possibly
something like 16 by 16 cubic spline coefficients in each plane, and then maybe like 12 slices, so like 16 by 16 by 12, something like that. So it's underdetermined.
37 or 32, that was per plane?
No, that's all together, but there's a source and a detector. So if you had 32, you'd have 1,024 measurements, right? Because you'd have 32 sources, 32 detectors.
You use all combinations.
Right. So we use all. So we usually have something like 750 measurements. So it's an underdetermined problem, right? Yeah. So we use if you'd used obviously just a Newton method with no regularization, it wouldn't work. So you have some regularization to take care of that.
Thank you very much.
One more question.
The objects you're looking for, searching, are very smooth.
Yeah.
So it makes sense to use global smooth functions
such as polynomials and
something like this or
exponentials.
Did anybody try this?
Well, we're using cubic spline.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I mean you could use it to solve polynomials.
As far as I know, that hasn't been tried. Yeah. I guess we could do that. Okay.
Great. Well, thank you very much.